morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksmann Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM and on HD1 in the Tri-State area, and worldwide on nyuirish.net/radio hour. So, whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksmann Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish-American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksmann and Loretta Brennan Glucksmann, Glucksmann Ireland House, NYU, has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since our founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I'm delighted to be in a position to share with you today the lecture delivered by a very special visitor to campus this past week. I'm speaking specifically about Monday night, and we had the pleasure of welcoming the President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, to campus here at Washington Mews on the occasion of his delivery of the 11th annual Emile Noël Lecture. Professor Gráinne de Burka, who is a well-known and very accomplished and very nice scholar, friends of mine studied under her in Florence in Italy about 10 years ago when I was actually there. Professor de Burka organized the event, and as usual, Michael D. Higgins did us proud in terms of reflecting on the European Union and many of the themes and scholarly arguments and principles around the state of the European Union as it is at this point in time. So I'm delighted to take this opportunity to share with you President Michael D. Higgins lectured as delivered in the law school on Monday night. So you'll be hearing basically from Michael D. Higgins for the rest of the show. There are some introductions from the head of the law school and from Professor de Burka herself as well. And we will continue it next week with the Q&A part of the lecture. Now, before I move on to that lecture, I would like to remind you that on Thursday night, we have a great event coming up. We're welcoming Sean D. McGraw, whose most recent book is How Parties Win, Shaping the Irish Political Arena. And it basically looks at how Ireland's three major political parties gained and maintained dominance. So that's next Thursday. That is October 8th. I can't believe we're into October already. Now, of course, Ireland House is busy later today, and it has been busy over the last few days. We welcomed Professor Tom Bartlett on Thursday night, and last night we kicked off Irish Screen America New York. And Irish Screen America's events are continuing today and tomorrow, Sunday. So if you're interested in catching some great Irish film, please go to our website and find out more. So I will hand you over to the talk delivered by President Michael D. Higgins, President of Ireland. Enjoy, folks.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Trevor Morris, and I'm the Dean of the Law School here at NYU. I want to welcome all of you. Thank you for joining us for the 11th annual Emile Noël Lecture here at NYU Law School. The lecture this year is being presented by His Excellency, the President of Ireland, Michael Higgins, and his lecture is titled The European Union Towards a Discourse of Reconnection, Renewal, and Hope. President Higgins will be formally introduced in just a moment by my colleague, but let me say how personally grateful I am to him for joining us tonight and how much we're all looking forward to hearing from him. Let me also say thank you to the many members of the Irish community who've joined us. I know many of you from some distance to be here tonight. We're grateful that you've joined us as well. Let me say a word or two about the Emile Noël Lecture. The lecture series is hosted by our Jean Monnet Center for International and Regional Economic Law and Justice here at NYU Law School. The Jean Monnet Center focuses on the study of international and European economic integration and European Union law, and it's directed by our colleague Grania de Burka. The Emile Noël Lecture promotes an awareness of the current state of the European Union. And each year, a prominent member of the legal and political administration of the Union is welcome to present their perspective on the state of the European Union. In recent years, we've had lectures presented by the Vice President of the European Court of Justice and the former Prime Minister of Greece, among others. My happy duty now to introduce Grania de Burka, who will introduce President Higgins. Grania is our Florence Ellenwood Allen Professor of Law, Faculty Director of the Hauser Global Law School, and Director of the Jean Monnet Center. She is one of the leading scholars on European Union law and its relationship to national legal systems and the international legal order. She joined us on the faculty in 2011 from Harvard, having previously spent time here as a research fellow and as a Hauser Global Visiting Professor. An outstanding scholar and teacher and colleague. Grania really is a treasured member of our community, and I'm happy to give her the microphone now. Grania de Burka.
So, Your Excellency, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to introduce tonight the person who's going to deliver the 11th annual Emile Noël Lecture at NYU and at our Jean Monnet Center for European and International Economic Law and Justice. So as the Dean mentioned, and as you'll see from the brochure, we've been proud to welcome a line of distinguished heads of state and government from European member states and presidents of the various European institutions in previous years to give this Emile Noël Lecture. But it gives me particular pleasure this year, not only because of my own connection to the country he represents, but also for many more reasons, to welcome the President of Ireland to give this lecture. Agus Sávór sin, bawatlam fóid mór a chur rivan uachtarán, agus a bhean céile, chuig gul scoil nua árach, agus chuig an scoil dílí an seo nach. Let me say a few words first about the institution of the Irish Presidency before I go on to introduce the current holder of that office. So since 1938, not long after regaining its independence, Ireland has had a succession of distinguished presidents, men of dignity and character, elected by popular vote to represent the Irish people and the Irish state. And the understanding is that this presidency was not to be a political office, but primarily a ceremonial one, intended to provide the nation with a figurehead, a person of high distinction, who'd represent the people on occasions, official occasions outside and inside the state. And so it was with each of the six men who held that office for several decades. But then in 1990, Ireland elected its first female president, Mary Robinson, who was widely considered by the end of her term to have transformed the presidency. It wasn't any longer a ceremonial role for distant, albeit highly respected figures to appear primarily on state occasions and remain largely silent on matters of the day. But she injected an enormous energy into the presidential office, reached out to different communities and spoke up on matters of social concern and justice. Her presidency was then followed by the election of another female president, Mary McAleese, who continued the high-profile, energetic style of an engaged approach and a similarly sympathetic, outreaching style. And I hope His Excellency will not be offended if I say that maybe there was some trepidation in the run-up to the recent presidential election as to whether, if a man were to be elected this time, could any man possibly live up to the expectations generated by the two Marys. So... But we're all delighted to say that no sooner was this current president elected than it became immediately obvious that those expectations would be more than met. So Michael D. Higgins has for several decades already been a much respected and beloved figure in Irish life and a leading public intellectual. He began his working life as a factory worker and a clerk before going on to become the first in his family to access higher education, going on to study at University College Galway, of which he's now an honorary professor, to the University of Manchester and to Indiana University here in the United States. His talents, achievements, and I would say even his identities are multiple. He's been an academic lecturing in political science and sociology at University College Galway. He's a poet, having published four collections of poetry, a politician, a writer and broadcaster, a leading promoter of the arts, reinvigorating the Irish film industry, supporting the theatre, music and literature, as well as a strong promoter of the Irish language, and very importantly, a long-time human rights activist. In his political career, he's been a mayor, a TD, that was a member of the Irish Parliament, a senator, minister for the arts, culture and the Gaeltacht, which is the parts of Ireland where Irish is still spoken as a native language. In his political career, he's spoken often about ethics and the need for a new ethical approach to politics. And I think in his case, these haven't just been hollow words, as they are for many, but his own track record as a public servant for many years and decades shows that he actually put his own advice into practice, and he stood out for his willingness to stand up for his principles, and I think where necessary, to speak out against the prevailing consensus. And while he is Ireland's first citizen and representative, his identity and his work, I think, has not just been as an Irish citizen, but also as a European citizen and as an internationally engaged actor. He's long campaigned on matters of international human rights and justice, writing and working on issues arising in Nicaragua, Chile, Cambodia, El Salvador, Iraq, and Somalia. And in 1992, he was awarded a prize named after another famous Irishman, Sean McBride, by the International Peace Bureau for this work. More recently, he's been speaking out on Europe-wide issues, including a speech to the European Parliament in 2013 on issues of citizenship, solidarity and political legitimacy during very difficult times for the EU. And more generally, since being elected president, he's spoken out on many issues of social justice, not only in Ireland but across Europe, including disability, poverty, economic austerity, racism, homophobia and the refugee crisis. And always, I think, with the emphasis on the idea of inclusion and the importance of solidarity. It's wonderful for us tonight to see such a turnout for this lecture. It's wonderful for the law school, for the university, but also for the wider Irish community who, as the Dean said, have travelled from far and wide to be here. The topic and purpose of the Emil Noel lecture, again, as the Dean pointed out, is to reflect on the state of the European Union. And anyone who's interested in knowing something about the state of the European Union these days needs only to look at the front page of any newspaper, not only in Europe, but also here in the US. And I noticed this morning that Wolfgang Munchau, who's a writer on the EU for the Financial Times, wrote that Europe is suffering from 5 concurrent crises, a series of unforeseen shocks at different stages of development. And he mentions the refugee crisis from Syria, the Eurozone periphery debt, a global economic downturn, Russia's annexation of Crimea and its aftermath, and most recently Volkswagen's crimes and misdemeanors. So the President's lecture tonight, he has a challenge ahead of him, could not come at a more timely moment, and we're looking forward very much to hearing what he has to say. So for all these and for many more reasons, we're delighted and honoured to welcome here tonight as our 11th annual Emil Noel lecture to speak to us on the subject of the European Union towards a discourse of reconnection, renewal and hope, His Excellency the President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I begin by thanking Dr. Gráinne de Bourcke, Director of the Jean Monnet Centre for Regional International Economic Law and Justice here at your university for her invitation to give the annual Emil Noel Lecture. Muile buicas, agus guim gach banach tart ar an operator siúl agat I gáivan dlí san ausgal coiúl seo, berbán. I am convinced that the title I have given to my lecture, let me say first of all, because it is important, that it is an honour to deliver this lecture in honour of a great European, and as you have just heard, as part of a sequence of lectures that have acquired a prestigious reputation. The title I have given to my lecture is a response to what I feel is a great contemporary democratic challenge, one of a regional kind insofar as its focus is the European Union, but one that is also global, the challenge of delivering and deepening democracy. I am convinced that the challenges of connecting citizens, of creating a space for vision and innovation in theory and policy, of offering hope at a time of great change, on a planet starred by growing inequality, these challenges are also global in nature. The discourse that prevails in relation to European issues at the present time, including the contributions of a distinguished, but at times lonely, set of academic voices, usually refers to a crisis of legitimacy in an institutional sense. And, of course, the roots of this discourse on the legitimacy gap is, these roots are as old as the Union itself. But they have acquired an increasing urgency due to the fiscal crisis of member states, the response of different governments, and the effect that these responses have had on their citizens. I want to suggest that if we are to respond adequately to this issue of legitimacy, it requires, as I believe, to look at the social sciences, remembering that all policy at some point bases itself, or at least seeks to justify itself, in terms of some scholarship of theoretical assumptions. In doing so, this examination of the social sciences, we need to test the transparency, the adequacy, and the power of such assumptions. Those assumptions that are at the heart of the informing theoretical field. I suggest that the discourse I seek in the title of my lecture assumes also a pluralism of scholarship, which frankly I believe has been in decline for some time. As a consequence, we are, as flies in a jar of honey, trapped in a single paradigm of thought in the social sciences and above all else in economic theory, from which we are finding it difficult to escape. Yes, we perceive the need for new thinking that will source new policies that might address the human challenges of social inclusion, poverty, poverty elimination, gender equality, public health, and security in its widest sense. We perceive this need, but we seem unable to act. A world of ethical possibility seems beyond our reach. We quite often wait for rating agencies daily to indicate what kind of future might be in store for us. That single paradigm of thought to which I refer has a specific historical location. It comes from a moment of hubris that suggested that literally all aspects of life could be fitted within an explanatory frame of extreme market theory. Citizens came to be replaced conceptually from what were defined as consumers who were assumed to rationally calculate how to maximize their satisfactions. That this model is now in crisis is not my suggestion. It is evident in the social statistics that we gather from developed, developing, and so-called undeveloped countries. That we need a new model is acknowledged even by conservative institutional sources. For example, in the World Development Report 2015, Mind, Society and Behavior, published recently by the World Bank Group. That report, in describing the current dominant hegemonic paradigm, references, of course, Milton Friedman's famous essay of 1953 on the methodology of positive economics. The report says, the individual actor could be understood as if he behaved like a dispassionate, rational, and purely self-interested agent, since individuals who did not behave that way would be driven out of the market by those who did. The assumptions of perfect calculation and fixed and wholly self-regarding preferences embedded in standard economic models became taken for granted beliefs in many circles. But the World Development Report of 2015 then goes on to say, economics has come full circle. After a respite of about 40 years, an economics based on a more realistic understanding of human beings is being reinvented. And this report shows that a more interdisciplinary perspective on human behavior can improve the predictive power of economics and provide new tools for development policy. Such a statement acknowledges the inadequacy of the prevailing model and paradigm of economic theory, one that is usually associated with the Chicago School. Paradigms of thought, of course, do change and can change. It is obvious in the history of theoretical physics, but I believe it can happen in every area of thought, as James Joyce clearly indicated in his approach to the novel. modernization theory in sociology is a good example. It is almost 50 years since I passed through New York for the first time on my way to study at Indiana University at Bloomington, Indiana. I was in my early 20s and one of the first Irish graduates to be offered an opportunity of postgraduate study in the social sciences in the United States. Sociology at the time was enjoying a renewed spring, different from that spring of the 19th century that had produced Marx, Weber, and Durkheim. Sociology was enjoying that spring, and many like me, in the autumn of 1966, were to be introduced to modernization theory as contained in the great canonical assertions of the Princeton studies of Gabriel Armand, Lucien Pye, Samuel Huntington, and others, with their binary evolutionary concepts of modernity versus tradition, civilization, progress, development, and the perception of the cultural features of traditional society that were perceived as hindering progress. That, of course, saw peasants as lacking, as it were, as McClelland would put it, achievement orientation. In time, such narrow frameworks did, of course, come to be questioned, and they were deconstructed by intellectually emancipated scholars after they had gone home, such as Orlando Falls Borda, and this is particularly so in the field of political science and anthropology. And paradigms changed. As to method at the time of the 1960s, there was great excitement at the new possibilities of quantification, of large-scale surveys based on sampling, and the capacity for analysis of a newly introduced large computing facility. The president of the American Philosophical Association was approached and it was suggested that the social sciences could now be a science like the other sciences. The social sciences then went on to increasingly focus on individual opinions and preferences rather than the discourses and politics that shaped those preferences. Preferences, it was assumed, preceded, existed separately from cognitive discourse, and they could be directly modeled in rational utility terms. Missing from the narrative of the times was any analysis of the form or the location of the changing nature of power. And at the edge of the discourse, C. Wright Mills' sociological imagination stood as an accusing text to the self-satisfied times in the academy. It was a decade later, Southern Illinois, that I read for the first time Alvin Gouldner's The Coming Crisis of Western Sociology. And I've had that work ringing in my head through all the years. In the emphasis, as his approach to middle-range theory, the emphasis that Gouldner placed on the need for good scholarship to adhere to the discipline of declaring what he called one's domain assumptions. That is the framework one took for granted as the given, the normal. He suggested this had to be declared, presented in advance. The paradigm declared, good scholarship required one to be open, to allow one's taken for granted reality that preceded any research to be open to question. I look back, not infrequently at that time, when the possibility of our paradigm articulation, shift, change, scrutiny, and reflection seemed to offer a set of possibilities that would make pluralist scholarship the norm and enable scholarly hypotheses to make their way towards generating a diversity of policy options. Sadly, I say it. Sadly, many academic institutions have resiled from any commitment to such a pluralist scholarship. And this stands as background, as a global background in intellectual terms, to the contemporary issues we must face, including those in the European Union. There are, of course, particular issues that arise within the Union itself, urgent issues as to whether it will be possible to have an institutional or systemic integration, which most commentators agree is necessary, and also a parallel social integration that would receive the support of the citizens of the Union. But sticking with my primary suggestion, the assumptions of theory, as it informs discourse, are perhaps even more important because they define what is possible and what can be imagined. The assumptions determine the basis on which power can be exercised or regulated, and they determine the basis on which issues such as integration are approached. But unchallenged theoretical frameworks, failed and failing paradigms and doctrines can disguise reality and contribute to the separation, and I suggest the alienation, of citizens from their political institutions. Now, if the current crises within Europe, and they are multiple, as I have suggested, have an intellectual as well as political and economic dimension, we must recognize too, and I do recognize, that the European Union has within it, I believe, the capacity to bring into being a new discourse that achieves a fairer, more inclusive union. One that we can come to know, understand, and with political will bring into being. But I believe that the political will, which would enable such a new vision for the future to prevail, I think it does exist and is now being evidenced, for example, at citizen level. The public response, for example, to the position of refugees arriving in Europe in recent times has for the most part demonstrated a deeply humanitarian instinct. If, as we all hope, 2015 is to be marked by achievements of agreements on climate change and on a new approach to sustainable development, a change of consciousness at a global level also seems possible. It beckons, as it were, in an emancipatory direction. Is it then, one might ask, also possible that to aspire to a response at European and global level to the threat to democracy that is posed by increasing global inequality and a largely unaccountable financialized global economy. So let us consider then for a moment the context in which the positive view of Europe, developed and advanced by Emile Noël and others, was conceived. For them, the memory of war and the near extension of European culture was ever present in their minds, these pioneers of the Union, in its early manifestations. And their vision was one of peace and prosperity, based on core values of reconciliation and solidarity. But in that vision, the role of the state and of the interstate institutions which were being constructed was understood as important, and as mediating in nature, balancing as they did the historical tensions between the interests of capital and labour, or as Wolfgang Strieck has defined it in more recent times, balancing the objectives of social justice and market justice. That balance defined the post-war boom and served as a context for significant social progress in the United States, too, spurred on by such work as that of Michael Harrington's The Other America, Poverty in the United States. However, it would be irrevocably broken in the period beginning in the 1980s as growth slowed and the view took hold that prosperity and the balancing of interests could only be sustained by a weakening of the state. In a relatively short period, the widely disseminated views associated earlier with Friedrich von Hayek and Milton Friedman took a powerful grip on intellectual life. That hegemony was achieved in a conscious exercise of institutional and academic power. It released a very concrete set of political principles, and it set the terms for the position that Europe and other regions find themselves in today. Over time, policy became ensnared within a single hegemonic model built on the assumption of the human actor as a utility-maximizing rational being. These intellectual assumptions, then, were the source of an economic policy that was, for example, the very antithesis of the earlier Keynesianism of the post-war decades. And, of course, as to academic work, within the academy in many places, dissent and heterodoxy would be on some occasions silenced and more often marginalized. And far beyond Europe, from the impact of the fall of the Berlin Wall, one can trace an ideological drift that inter alia defined language itself in a new way. For example, freedom in the public discourse becomes freedom from state regulation. Support for the concept of public goods and public services, for the public world, for the enrichment of the public space, for the definition of culture, of broadcasting as a shared public activity, were all put under pressure from a populism based on radical individualism. All of it, of course, predicated on an assumption of an infinite economic growth that carried no burden of ecological responsibility or concern. The state as an institution, which after World War II had been used as an instrument to set about the rebuilding of Europe, offering health care, decent housing, and social protection to its veterans, their families, and their successors, came in the decades from the 80s to the present to be regarded as an institutional obstacle to growth and prosperity. Aspects of state regulation, of course, did survive for a while, but the financialization of the global economy was now well underway. And in the process, the profoundly ideological notion that state regulation was an obstacle to freedom came to achieve a tacit, unquestioned acceptance. Be it in the United States or the European Union, the stripping away of regulation can be shown to have shifted power to the beneficiaries of a growing inequality. And over the period since 1980, and in accelerated form in more recent years, gaps in income and wealth have widened generally and regionally in the European Union and in the United States. So thus, our present circumstances in Europe are dominated, yes, by different forms of crises, of which reference has been made already. The crisis of debt, the crisis of unemployment and economic stagnation, and institutional crises at several levels, including the challenge the integrity of the Union itself. However, the source of and foundation for economic policy, the evolution of this theoretical model of neoliberal unrestrained capitalism with minimal regulation, now provokes a challenge to the democratic institutions in which citizens had placed their trust. Recognizing this reality and taking it into account in our response is central, I believe, to any understanding of the contemporary position of the European Union and the resolution of its difficulties. And I can tell you, this view is a view that is held by other heads of state in the European Union, if not all governments. The centrality of debt to the European economic crisis and to the wider question of integration has been neatly summarized inter alia by Klaus Off, giving the title Europe Entrapped to his recent article in Eurozine. Off's response to the present crisis is critical of European Union strategies to date. He writes, a central problem for the Euro rescue scheme is that the banking crisis became a state budgetary crisis, which then became the crisis of European integration we have today. This, in turn, is a crisis of renationalizing our sense of solidarity, a crisis in which the rich countries of Europe impose saving packages upon their poorer neighbours, which are supposed to win back the confidence of the finance industries. Now, if we take perhaps the most troubling of the contemporary problems, They have scandalously high and unaccountable levels of youth unemployment. We see writ large the profound consequences that economic policies and deregulation of finance have had on social cohesion. And indeed, as research has shown, on productivity at a personal and social level. For the European Union 28, the most recent Eurostat figures disclose youth unemployment running at 20.4% compared to 10.9% of the general population. You generally take the unemployment figure and multiply it by two. In some of the worst affected members, the picture is even bleaker. Spain has an unemployment rate of 22%, but a youth unemployment rate of 48.6%. Greece has a rate of unemployment of 25%, but a youth unemployment rate that is currently running at 51.8%. And Croatia and Italy have youth unemployment rates of over 40%. The possibilities of a generation in Europe are withering in a context of confusion and, I believe inadequate policy responses. By any measure, these are stark figures, and they demonstrate the ongoing impact of the banking and financial collapse, yes, of 2007-08, and the linked issue of unsustainable public debt in many states. Yes, in Ireland, unemployment is falling and currently stands at 9.5%, but of course our further progress will be contingent on a wider European recovery, which I suggest remains fragile. At those times, however, looking back within the Union, when growth, however inadequately defined, produced surpluses, an unaccountable system could drift on. Citizens could be encouraged to compete with each other in terms of consumption in a highly individualized sense. Now, however, with inflation near zero, the demand side of the national economy continues to contract in most countries, and youth unemployment is creeping up. As economies moved from a period of growth and governments were forced to cut services and suspend infrastructural investment, fear and tension are the inevitable consequences. These consequences fall most heavily on the poor, and within society, hope is eroded among the young, whose expectations, after all, were formed in a debt-expanded, financialized economy, rather than in any version of a real economy that emphasized the possession of skills and creativity delivered in a socially purposeful way. Recognizing this intellectual and public policy context is important, I believe, for coming to terms with the disconnect between the citizens of the European Union and their representative institutions. Democratic participation is now at historically low levels across the continent. In times of economic contraction and reduced state expenditure on services, elected representatives, as in many other places and times, take the hit of public anger, as they are perceived to be the most proximate and available sources of authority, while at the same time they are perceived as powerless to act. And politics itself and the status of governments and parliaments has been eroded as crucial decisions that affect people's lives are increasingly taken outside such an institutional accountability. That is the legitimacy crisis, and it is one that is emerging at various levels. Indeed, this grounding question of legitimacy is a primary focus for thinkers such as Jürgen Habermas, Wolfgang Strieck, or Klaus Hoff, who all share a broad consensus that the weakness of politics that we are witnessing in Europe has been fundamentally affected by the political changes that came about in the 80s and the 90s. In Europe, a growing gap has opened between, on the one hand, the advocates of a social Europe who simply wish many of them of the older ones to protect aspects of social protection, parts of which, such as the British National Health Service or Scandinavian social protection, are iconic political achievements of the past. And on the other hand, those under the mask of labour market flexibility seek the surrender of hard-won rights in the workplace and society as the entry qualification to, if you like, an undefined global economy. The outcomes of this conflict result, as I believe, in our shared vulnerable planet, being scarred by a growing inequality, an inequality that has implications for health, housing, work, participation, life itself. And that is what constitutes the concern, I believe, of many on the European street. But a response, what might have been, I think, the presentation of a choice in political terms, has been dampened by the moving of electoral competition to what is regarded as the political centre. A centre, of course, that in recent times functions under the dangerous shadow of some populisms. In some states, such a choice of the centre has come to be defined as the fullness of political choice. So I do want to say that there is nothing uniquely European about our position, although it may be that in the multi-level structure of the European Union, the tension between democracy and global markets is particularly pronounced. We are, some scholars have suggested recently, living at the emergence of a new form of capitalism with a global reach, one which existing democratic institutional arrangements are failing to render accountable. Then too, where previously forms of connection between economy and society could be contested in the political discourse, and discussion of redistribution, of poverty proving, of reducing inequality was possible, now these issues are presented as very much secondary to the management of the newly socialized public debt. And as parliaments lose capacity, as the realm of the social state shrinks, the feeling on the street is that more and more people are being asked to adjust themselves and their lives to fiscal policies which it is suggested are beyond the ken of ordinary folk. The adjustment of the citizenry to debt costs and forecasts may be called austerity, but what is masked by such a term is perceived by many as simply a submission to forces that are not under any democratic control and at the same time are delivering a transfer of wealth to private creditors. Wolfgang Strieck has described in great detail the resulting fear that is being felt in the European street, that at a global level, a capitalism without democracy is emerging. The scale of the debt problem and the ongoing economic difficulties facing Europe are enormous. And as governments struggle with these great questions, diverse proposals have been brought forward by scholars and political scientists. Jürgen Habermas makes a case for a new institutional transnationalism. While acknowledging the scale of the democratic challenge this would present, Wolfgang Strieck seeks as an alternative an exit from a dysfunctional version of monetary union badly introduced. Klaus Off takes a pessimistic view and highlights the gap between what he sees as fiscally necessary in terms of debt sharing and the political obstacles to the necessary changes across the Eurozone. Off is a representative figure when he suggests that the only possible solution may lie in the area of social policy. Now, you have been introduced to the Irish Constitution, and teasing out the various policy options at this difficult moment is the very onerous work of national governments rather than for me as a head of state. I would suggest, however, that their efforts in bringing forward economic and institutional reforms will not, if they are taken in isolation, for example, in the fiscal sphere only, address the deeper existential issues of legitimacy facing Europe. Recognizing the dominant influences, I believe, of the contemporary forms of capital and its relationship to institutional accountable forces, is crucial if we are to reforge a new adequate relationship between the economic and social policy. I am not suggesting that there are not grounds for hope. The crisis at an economic and at a political level is deep, but crisis can provide an opportunity for a new strategic direction, for renewal, and for pluralist scholarship. As a beginning, however, we need, I suggest, to break free intellectually, so as to give ourselves the possibilities that our sustainable future demands. But paradigm departure can be difficult, even painful. In a passage near the end of his famous book, The History of Development, Gilbert Rist wrote of the difficulty of getting to a new paradigm in intellectual work and policy. Only a new paradigm can alter not the way things are, but our way of conceiving them. That is, can make it possible for us to think what is today unthinkable. History shows us a series of turnarounds that have changed the face of the world. What value today have the certainties of Galileo's adversaries, of the inquisitors hunting down witches, of the colonizers so full of their sacred trust of civilization? We are not living in circumstances that cannot be changed. Inequality at global, regional, or national levels is not some form of natural law. Heads of state, heads of government, legislators, civil society, many are now recognizing that distributional issues are a necessary part of the discourse that is necessary if we are to restore the possibility of the legitimacy that is needed for systemic integration. But the need for revision of institutional architecture in the European Union has to be primarily directed at the needs of the Union and its citizens. And only within that can the systemic institutional change needed in relation to the banking sector, the currency and economic stability be achieved. As to how we can act in response to the economic issues, and particularly issues, social issues such as youth and employment, in the short term, yes, there are proposals available to us in such work as that of Professor Anthony Atkinson, for example, in his recent work Inequality. He explores the specific historical and political context and causes of contemporary forms of inequality, and he makes the following observation. Crucially, I do not accept that rising inequality is inevitable. It is not solely the product of forces outside our control. There are steps that can be taken by governments, acting individually or collectively, by firms, by trade unions and consumer organizations, and by us as individuals, to reduce the present levels of inequality. And I was delighted to know that Professor Atkinson will chair the new Commission on Global Poverty, which is being set up by the World Bank. Professor Atkinson goes on to make some proposals for policy, which I believe could be implemented within the parameters of the European Union. The proposals would build a social floor for the European Union, but also, I believe, in their exemplary effect, would have a global reach in addressing inequality. These are Professor Atkinson's proposals, not mine, but their central feature is that addressing inequality, arresting its deepening, breaking the cycle of exclusion and alienation, is achievable. In this regard, I have previously pointed out in the speeches I made to the European Parliament and the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, the obligations that arise under the Charter of Fundamental Rights and Freedoms and the obligations that arise under the revised Social Charter of the Council of Europe, I refer to them as providing an existing rights framework for such a social floor. And such proposals could serve as a beginning for the rebuilding of a social Europe, and do so within existing constitutional arrangements. And I find these suggestions attractive and valuable. I do ask myself, however, could this ever make its way into the current discourse in the European Union at institutional and political level? Yes, we should remember. We should remember the great achievements that have been made possible in the past. At its periods of greatest achievement and progress, the European Union has inspired the loyalty of its citizens because of the hope it represented, of a better society for all. If it is to survive and to flourish, Europe must regain the power to inspire and to offer hope. The Union is much to be proud of, after all, and to celebrate. And European membership has given impetus to so many inclusive decisions in member states. In the Irish case, membership of the Union has been a powerful impetus towards gender equality, for example. Its influence on environmental responsibility has been immense, and it has been used as both source and shelter for government decisions on sustainability. The principle, then, of free movement of peoples was once seen as a core value to be celebrated rather than merely as a labour market instrument or a legal rule to be circumvented. It was a cornerstone of the idea of Europe that enabled cultural and social interaction on an unprecedented scale. Just one example. In the area of education, the Erasmus scheme allowed young European people to study and work in other member states, exposing them to a different linguistic and cultural environment at a formative stage in their lives. Since 1987, 3 million Europeans have taken part in Erasmus, with 40% going on to settle abroad, and one-third marrying a citizen from another state. The Commission estimates that there has been 1 million babies born of Erasmus, in what Umberto has described as a sexual revolution, sweeping Europe, which he has argued should be extended beyond students to workers also. Travel is the nourishment for integration. And it may be sadly a fact, but predictable, that policies of fiscal consolidation or council reform are unlikely to produce such a romantic or demographic dividend. In the task of fostering political will for reform, the importance of symbolism too should not be underestimated. When intergovernmental meetings are called to discuss where the European Union must go, they usually conclude with a joint statement and what is called the family photograph. But on the street, very often what citizens believe they are hearing is not the necessary invitation to an urgent or any new understanding of economic or political circumstance, not to speak of change. As a result, for many, when the conditions of life itself cannot be reconciled with the image of authority and care and offer, they are pushed to ask the question, have things spun out of control? Has a new and unbridgeable fissure between public and power emerged? And in responding to this crisis then, and its institutional sources, some public intellectuals speak of what they see as an irreformable reality, of the need for a new moment of confrontation and total change when existing institutions can be swept away. I've read Slavoj Žižek's work as well, and I note this in it. But this may be heady stuff, but there are also those who see and recognize the human costs of such an outcome, who see how old badges of difference, ethnicity, belief, and bankrupt certainties of the past, so often and dangerously claimed to be absolute, could quickly move into the vacuum that would be created by a weakened parliamentarism, a shrunken state. How easily our publics could drift into a resile of old hatreds based on distortion. I remain committed to the European vision and to the founding principles of Europe. I believe that we still possess the capacity to provide the foundations for a renewed and strengthened union. But yet to provide hope, a positive vision at this crucial moment, I believe we must rediscover the enabling and inspiring principle of solidarity. Solidarity within the union and solidarity with the wider world. For after all, when Europe was in ruins after the war, the destruction was unavoidably in one's gaze. And then when European growth rates were achieved within a social model, modest redistributions could take place. And it may not have seemed necessary to have a widespread economic literacy. Many, assuming all was well, could drift from political participation. Adjustments in living conditions could be for activists the stuff of political competition as to the disposal of the fruits of growth. And a debate, we should, I think, on structure was seemed unnecessary. But we should remember, too, that period of the European Union's history when solidarity was privileged, when combat poverty, for example, was born in the 1970s and issues of inequality were addressed. And it is well within the capacity of the European publics to craft a new policy and institutional order, one that combines social cohesion with competitiveness. But the danger at the moment is that the discourse has stalled under the pressure of an insufficient paradigm of connection between economy and society. And the further danger is that without the political support of its people, the necessary institutional and policy changes will become ever less possible. So rebuilding a social Europe, I suggest, may require greatly increased tax and spend capacities on the part of the EU institutions. But at present, the political will for such policies and for the necessary ceding of sovereignty from the national level simply does not exist. But political will and reviving an active European citizenship requires comprehension, understanding and participation by citizens, facilitated, I suggest, by an economic literacy. And may I suggest that if literacy was an essential tool in securing the right to vote and be heard in Parliament in a previous century, now in contemporary conditions, economic literacy that can demystify banking, fiscal and real economy crisis seems necessary if we are to achieve an inclusive discourse, one that can address the widely reported alienation of citizens.
Coming towards the end of the programme, I'm Dr. Miriam Knighton, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM and on HD1 in the Tri-State area, and worldwide on nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, our email is ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour or to irishradio.com. Our theme music today is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Stay tuned for the Adrian Sanley Show up next on WBNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht.